Facebook Live. The link did cut off. You're back on up now. Hopefully you'll come back and join us here because we're having a conversation on both Facebook Live and on our Facebook fan page. Irene chimed in and she said, Casey nailed it. We have to change these politicians, allow the young minds and talents to thrive. We are talking about the fact that the FBI just released their newest report, and unfortunately it does not bode well for Baltimore City. It says that Baltimore had the worst homicide rate among the nation's 50 largest cities last year and the second highest violent crime rate overall. This is according to new data from the FBI. The grim news is just a reminder of what has been happening in this city since 2015. There were 342 homicides in Baltimore last year, 56 per 100,000 people who live in the city. That's the highest per capita in the city's history. And according to the FBI's report, it's the highest rate of any American city with more than 500,000 people. Now, Councilman John Bullock said that the neighborhoods are crying out. I beg to differ. I think our young black men are crying out. What do we do about the fact that our city is not going in the right direction? Now, you may disagree. Call me and tell me. But folks, we need to find out what's happening, and we need to be able to drill down deep to make some changes. We have Valerie on the phone from downtown Baltimore. Valerie, how are you? Valerie, how are you?
Hi. Hi. How you doing, Dr. Ted?
I'm doing well. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, over the period of time to all the callers, it sounds really great. Things sound great. Things look great on paper. But I've been in the streets talking to the young men and ask questions, and a great deal of them don't have high school diplomas.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a GED. They are on, a lot of them, even if they wanted to continue education, they have to get their GEDs. What programs do we have in Baltimore City to assist them with getting their GEDs?
And that's a good question, but I thought we had some. I thought we had some GED programs set up for young people who leave school at the age of 16, which they're legally allowed to do, but it's to help them finish up their education. I mean, I'm almost certain that we have some here.
And we need to disseminate that information. They don't know. They aren't looking. People need to go. We need to go out and hand them information. Or either, like, you're going to have your seminar.
We are definitely having our symposium, which we are working on. We should be able to announce the date by Friday. We're just working on securing the location.
Yeah, they need to. And then I agree with the night school again, because that gives them an opportunity to go to school at night, even if they go to work during the day.
Right.
Another thing is that, are you aware that I contacted the Maryland Apprenticeship and Training Program through Baltimore City? And I asked I sent them an email, from listening to your program about training and apprenticeship programs. They can be paid while they're in this program.
Well, see, there you have it. So they can make money. Okay.
Paid while they're in this apprenticeship program. And she has offered to come and speak at your, I keep calling it a seminar.
No, I don't shoot the symposium. I think that would be excellent.
I work for a university. Everything's a seminar. So, yes, she has offered to come and help in the sit down and brainstorm with us.
Okay, I like that.
Talk to the gentlemen out there, they're ashamed. They're ashamed because they don't have a high school diploma. They don't have a GED. And the pride is what's keeping some of them out
there. Right, right. To keep them continue to work on the street, and we have to find a way to turn that around.
Yeah, and they're hardcore. They're not going to, they're not going to come in and just humble themselves. They're not going to do that.
Okay.
So things have to be set up in a way or in a fashion where they feel comfortable with getting their GED. And then I think we need an entire building where we set up something for an outreach center, not an outreach center, but everything should be available so that when they do come in, that they are helped with.
Right. I completely agree with you. And that's the idea of trying to find a way to make it work so that it's simple for them, it's easy for them, and the transition would work for them.
That's right. So even though there are things available, we need to make it at their fingertips.
Right.
Then when they can come in and it'll be there and someone will help them through and they don't feel like humiliated.
Right.
You know, but we need to set this thing up. I think about the Black Panthers. And the reason why I bring them up is because they did everything for their community.
Right. They worked it. They did.
They did not depend on the government.
Right.
They did not depend on. And how come we have so many educated people and then we can't all get ourselves together enough to get a building and set these things up for everyone, for our kids, everyone to have access to.
And that is what we're looking at doing. I mean, we're looking at not with the building, but looking at trying to make some strides. I'm about to stop you there. Thank you so much for calling, Battery. We have Lolita on the phone. Lolita, you've been holding a while. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a really good, interesting conversation, so I did not mind. So many callers made some great points. Casey, for one, I just wanted to ask the question about, there are organizations I know of in Baltimore City that are working directly with some of these communities that we're talking about that have kids or young adults that are out there doing things that they should not be doing. And I'm wondering, are they going to be invited and brought into the process of this event that you're planning, as well as the different fraternities and sororities that are associated with our HBCUs, are they also going to
yes.
be invited? Because the thing that we need to talk about, like the previous caller said, is we need to learn how to create something for our own. In addition to all the wonderful things that the last caller just said, as far as potential opportunities out
right.
there, at Anne Arundel Community College, they have a course that will teach you about the cannabis industry. Because even though when they awarded those contracts out for dispensaries or growers in the state of Maryland, that our community was inadvertently, most of us was left
right.
out, or all of us was
right.
left out of participation.
Right.
There are more than one way of entry into that field.
Right.
So I would be interested. I'm interested in taking a course myself, but also that would be another avenue for us as a group to enter the field to make some money. So we need to think about how we can create jobs and employment opportunities.
No, I like that.
I'm
putting that down because part of what we're trying to figure out is what alternative can we offer to young brothers? If you're
right.
saying that you have to stop doing whatever you're doing and come into a different lifestyle, what are we offering them? Because not
yeah.
just take a just not just say stop dealing drugs. I mean, it's got to be something
right.
else. It's got to
yeah,
be something else they can do.
And the other thing, I work in the jail industry. I mean, and I interact with young people, and their mentality, their energy is so different from the older people there, because a lot of the older people have a sense of faith,
right,
and a sense of community, a sense of belonging. They've had that. A lot of the young kids don't have that.
Right.
They don't have families. Their moral codes and ethics is different from ours. They don't have faith, not in the sense that we do as older people. So from that perspective, you know, that's one of the things that makes them so hard, because they didn't grow up feeling like people were caring
right.
about them, connected to them, enough even to just smile at them.
And that's what I like
hello.
That. But they need to know that we're with them. Thank you so much, Lolita.
You're
we welcome. Have Leroy on the phone from West Baltimore. Leroy, how are you? Leroy, are you with us? All right, we'll move on from Leroy. We have Jarrell on the phone. Jarrell's a new caller from Baltimore County. Welcome to the family, Jarrell.
Oh, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
All right. And yeah, like she said, I was listening to y'all earlier. And me personally, I used to once be out there. So I also haven't graduated from school. But what it took, like me personally, I started seeing brothers kind of doing things like starting their own business and actually like being able to provide for themselves.
Right.
And, you know,
is that what convinced you to stop? Now, I want to be clear. You said you used to deal drugs. Is that correct? Or you wanted to be out there?
Yeah.
Okay, so how long did you deal drugs?
Oof. I mean, I'm like.
I'm assuming you're not doing it anymore. So.
Yeah,
okay.
Not.
Okay, so you used to run drugs. Now, let me ask you this. How much money did you take down per week? Just on average.
Probably like a couple of thousand.
Okay, so you took down about $2,000 or $3,000 per week running drugs, right?
Right.
So what is it? Because, I mean, you survived, and you say you're not doing it anymore. So, Jarrell, so we can understand this, because, you know, I can't speak from experience. I never ran drugs. I don't know what that life is like. What turned you around?
Getting tired of going to jail, like you said, the feeling of, well, I mean, every morning you never really know.
Right.
That's why a lot of these guys is getting, like, smoking, drinking, popping pills, because they mentally trying to, you know, trying to escape from reality.
Right.
So that's what's making everybody kind of, you mean, whatever, turn up all the time, because they're mentally not trying to, you know, trying to deal with reality.
So you stopped dealing drugs, bringing down $2,000 to $3,000 per week because you got tired. What we're trying to figure out here is that, Jarrell, how can we take that? Because waiting for our brothers to get tired is not probably the best solution, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So how do we reach into their lives?
With me, like I said, like you said, at one point it didn't feel like I had no hope or nothing. So
right.
I wound up having I had my son. So it was just the sense of kind of wanting change. But like I said, even that wasn't enough.
I had to see
other brothers like actually doing something different and actually benefiting from it.
Okay.
Like,
so seeing brothers in your life who made it out was something that encouraged you.
Yes, and
okay.
Like I said, seeing brothers kind of having businesses, and like even now, I'm still kind of trying to retrain my mind. I go to like little business meetings, and
right.
It's like it's giving me a sense of hope. Like it's putting the confidence in there that wasn't there.
Okay,
because a lot of guys don't have confidence. The only thing they got confidence is what they think they know is, and that's the streets.
And that's the streets.
The streets only teaching them, you know, foolishness. So it's like, you know, it's the sense of not having confidence in the fact that you can do nothing else but what you think you know.
All right.
That's, you know, that's not actually the truth. Like, it's so much stuff that these brothers can be doing.
And it's trying to find a way to get it to them. Thank you so much, Jarrell. I appreciate you calling. New caller. I want to bring into the conversation, because we're going to continue with the calls, but I want to bring in Dr. Lawrence Brown. Just joined me here in the studio. He's a professor at Morgan State University. He's the co-founder of hashtag Be More Lead Free, a campaign to raise awareness about lead poisoning in Baltimore. In June 2018, he was honored by OSI Baltimore, that's Open Society Institute, with the Bold Thinker Award. Now, you might know him from his work with the Black Butterfly and the White L, and his work regarding racial segregation in Baltimore being an apartheid city. I want to know, he was just chosen. The Root puts out their list of 100 of the most influential Black folks in America, most influential African Americans. I want to say I did not make the list, but Dr. Lawrence Brown did. I don't know what's going on. Anybody, obviously, didn't get my vote because I was only voting for myself. We have Dr. Brown in the studio. Because I wanted to, as we're talking about what's going on with this homicide list, in addition to giving our opinion, and I appreciate everybody's opinion and what you think would happen, I want to make sure we have some historical context to help us understand how Baltimore got to be the way it is. So, Dr. Brown, thank you so much for joining the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yep, you're a superstar now, so glad you were able to stop by. So we had this list to come out, and Jordan, Glord, Buddy, Leroy, Robert, don't hang up. I'm going to get Dr. Brown to chime in very quickly. Baltimore had the worst homicide rate among the nation's 50 largest cities and the second highest crime rate overall.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that this grim news is only a reminder of what has been happening since 2015, because we can't seem to turn things around. Now, this rate, we had 342 homicides in Baltimore last year, 56 per 100,000 people. That was not only the highest per capita in our history here in Baltimore City, it was the highest rate of any American city with more than 500,000 people. It is significantly higher than the rate in big cities. So Councilman John Bullock said that the neighborhoods are crying out. I said, mm-hmm. No, young brothers are crying out, because mm-hmm. young brothers, according to TJ Smith, are killing each other at a rate that is astounding. We are mm-hmm. losing young Black men in this city. Can you help us make some sense that we didn't just get here yesterday?
Right.
It didn't happen since Freddie Gray.
Well,
how do we get here?
The thing is, both of those statements are true. The notion that, you know, Black men are crying out, neighborhoods are crying out. Well, you can't save black lives if you don't make black neighborhoods matter. Mm-hmm. So they're both important. Human beings are like flowers, and neighborhoods are like soil in a garden. So if you have neighborhoods with bad soil, bad schools, underfunded schools, if you have a redlining that reduces the amount of capital that neighborhoods receive, if you have people living in a food desert, high levels of lead poisoning, then what kind of human beings do you expect to grow up in those type of disinvested redlined black communities? So the soil is in the neighborhoods. And if you don't invest in, I don't even like the term invest anymore. If we don't repair our neighborhoods, mm-hmm. because redlining is a part of ongoing historical trauma that has been inflicted on black neighborhoods in this city for the past 100 years. And if we don't fix our neighborhoods, then we can't fix the issues in those neighborhoods, including violence. And one reason that violence is so high in Baltimore due to racial segregation, and I'm talking about government enforced racial segregation, mm-hmm. is that it creates a type of competition for resources. I already said redlining restricts the amount of capital access that people have. Well, when you have a community like Freddie Gray's that goes decades without investment, decades without repair for the damage that was done, then you have this infighting that results. Whether it's infighting on the streets for drugs in the drug trade, or trying to find and create resources so that people can make ends meet. Racial segregation is the platform upon which all of these social ills are weaponized. And I think until we deal with that construct, knowing that human beings are like flowers, mm-hmm. our neighborhoods are like soil, we can't grow the best flowers if we don't tend to the soil.
And it doesn't seem to be a real focus on growing good flowers. So just carry that analogy out. It's mm-hmm. not as if those who are on top, I'm talking about the elected officials, mm-hmm. using this same garden metaphor, mm-hmm. they are not concerned about the flowers in our garden. If the flowers would in so many ways be extended to our children, mm-hmm. then you would expect a neighborhood, a community, a city, a nation that loves its children mm-hmm. and sees its children as flowers, mm-hmm. would make sure the soil is rich, would water them, would talk mm-hmm. to them, what people do who have the green thumb, and I don't.
Right.
I don't like flowers.
Right.
All my flowers die because I don't pay any attention to them.
Right.
But that's what's happening to people, though.
It is, and it's happening because where are we watering? We're watering the harbor. We're watering Port Covington.
White owl.
We gave Port Covington and the richest man in Baltimore, Kevin Plank, we gave his development company $660 million in TIF bonds in 2016.
Yes.
And so, you know.
And can't get clean water
in the
90s,
we gave $100 million to Sandtown, and we act like that was supposed to be enough.
And it wasn't enough.
If it takes $660 million to build a mini city in Port Covington, then it's going to take at least that mm-hmm. to not only build up a Sandtown or a Curtis Bay. If we're going to repair and build these neighborhoods so that people have real access, opportunity, and resources, then what we have to do is actually repair. And what I call for is neighborhood reparations, because the city itself has inflicted apartheid policies and practices upon our redlined black neighborhoods. So violence really that we see on the street is really a function of the structural violence practiced in our politics.
All right.
And so that's where we have to actually, we do have to focus on both. But I would argue if we want to focus on the street violence, we have about 4 or 5 sites for Safe Streets, which is a violence reduction initiative. We need about 40 or 50 sites mm-hmm. of Safe Streets. We're underfunding violence reduction and overfunding hyper policing.
That's where we started. I mean, when 7 out of 10 top paid people in Baltimore City are cops, and one cop, number one, made $150,000 in overtime last year. Well, we have some real questions. We know what you love. Let's get back to these callers. Dr. Brown's going to stay with us for a little while, I hope. All right, let's get the callers going. We have Leroy on the phone. Leroy, how are you?
I'm fine, Dr. K. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Oh, that's good. Dr. K, I think a lot of this, violence, can be dealt with in terms of conflict resolution.
Mm.
And, I would think that if you could, somehow have a underground street court and get all the parties involved and just have a little mock court and conflict resolute the problem, something might happen with the violence.
I like that, an underground street corps, but actually teaching young people in the schools about conflict resolution. I am a big proponent of that. Our young people, and I'm going to say some older ones as well, but we're just focusing on young people for a minute, don't know what to do with conflict, anger, frustration. And so violence becomes the next natural step if there is no alternative.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Leroy. I appreciate that. Let me get to a couple more calls, and I'm going to come back to you, Dr. Brown. We have Bailey on the phone. Bailey's a new caller from Crofton. Bailey, how are you? Welcome to the family.
I'm fine. How are you, Dr. K?
I'm doing well.
Okay, I'm just calling just because I went to Washington, D.C. about 2 weeks ago for the Congressional Black Caucus.
Yes.
And I went on to a forum. It was called The Future of Work. So I took a snapshot of some nonprofit policies that are in place, and I thought it would be good for people to hear about. One is called the Year Up Program, and it says it provides urban young adults with skills that will empower them to reach professional goals in higher education.
Right.
The second one is the C4Q program, and that's a 10-month program that teaches coding and professional skills to adults in diverse and low-income backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Another is called Launch Code. It's accessible education and training and paid apprenticeships and job placement.
Yes.
And then Tech Hire, so it works with community partners.
Okay.
For training options. I think a lot of the violence stems from lack of opportunity. And until people figure out a way to make money, and then it may not be as fast as, you know, selling drugs on the street, but if they have opportunities to do something like this through nonprofit programming, it might help.
Thank you so much. I took them all down. Thank you, Bailey. We're going to hold it here for just a moment. When we come back, Jordan, I'm going to take you first. Then it'll be Glord, then Buddy, then Robert in that order. There's also one more line open for you, 410-319-8888. Keep it here.
Hello, I'm Justina Pollard, producer of Today with Dr. K. I just want to take this time to thank you for your donations to the Dr. K Teacher Depot. Your support was so appreciated, and guess what? The doors to the depot are open to any teacher needing water, sanitizers, or tissue for your classroom. Just contact WEAA and tell us what time you want to pick it up. Thanks again for your support. As you know, here at Today with Dr. K, we love our babies. WEAA is absolutely the voice of the community.
Here's what you missed on Mornings with Mikkel.
My understanding, the fact that he sat voluntarily for a civil deposition and he made statements and he was advised that the investigation in the criminal case had already ended and that there would not be any charges. And then you sat and made statements that came back to incriminate him.
Yeah.
And so therefore, in any other circumstances, this case would not have been brought. But it was Bill Cosby, and I do believe that race played a role in that.
WEAA, absolutely the voice of the community.
News headlines, events, podcasts, and more. WEAA.org.
Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. We're having a conversation here about the fact that Baltimore has the worst homicide rate among the nation's 50 largest cities. I'm joined here by Dr. Lawrence Brown. You know his work with the Black Butterfly and White L, helping us get some historical context. I told Jordan he was next. Jordan's a new caller calling in. Welcome to the family, Jordan. How are you?
Yes, I'm okay. Dr. K.
Yes.
We do not respect ourselves.
Okay.
We do not respect one another. As a people, I'm from the country. I grew up in the country. And if a neighbor had a problem, I will never forget, a neighbor's house burned down.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in that neighborhood came over and helped that family to rebuild that house. And that's what we do not have in Baltimore. It has changed here. I'm almost 80 years of age. We must respect one another. The look out for the children and the old people, elderly people. And that's what it takes.
All right. Thank you so much. Now, I appreciate you, Jordan, this idea that we don't respect ourselves and we don't respect others. So do you find that? I don't know about that. I wonder, Dr. Brown, if within our Black communities, I think we have more support and love for our community and for each other than people are willing to admit. I don't think we've turned on each other to such an extent that we don't know how to come together.
Well, I mean, I would like to say that I think we, our elected officials, in particular our Black elected officials, oftentimes don't respect Black neighborhoods.
Right, I agree with
they
that.
They aren't working to dismantle the Baltimore apartheid that I talked about earlier.
Right.
And so I think, you know, when you have Black leadership come into power after the age of civil rights and Black power, did they actually do the work to dismantle the systems of oppression that they were stepping into? And I think, you know, Black elected officials, the political elite in our community, you know, they're often put into place by corporate developers. They're often put in, if their campaigns are financed by wealthy white folks. And so are they really actually working to dismantle the policies and practices, the system and budgets that help reinforce the apartheid that we know and see today, with Baltimore being a Category 5 hyper-segregated city? Now, Category 5 is like a hurricane.
Right.
It's the most intense, the most devastating. Baltimore is in that category. You want to know what other cities are in that category? Chicago, Flint,
all on the
Detroit,
list. All on the
Cleveland.
List.
And did you see who's at the top of the murder list?
Yes.
St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago.
On. Same cities.
The same cities same that cities. Are Category 5 hyper-segregated
think about that,
are
folks.
The ones that are high in homicides. Now, to the caller's point, you have social dysfunction when you have hyper-segregation. Because again, you have a paucity of resources. People are desperate in these redlined communities because there's no capital coming in.
No.
There's no investment.
But you still have to eat. You still have to
right.
pay rent.
So
still
that's where the disrespect is coming from.
Yes.
When you have structural disrespect, you're going to have interpersonal disrespect. So I think we got to always think about flowers and the soil.
Back
flowers
to that
analogy. And the soil. Human beings are not independent of our environment. We are part of our environment. We're eco-social beings. So it's not just a program or a nice little, you know, nonprofit that's functioning to do something. That's nice. But if without addressing the structural piece in concert with those programs,
it won't
then we're putting
anything.
People right
yes.
back in the same environment. And what are 9 times out of 10 people going to go back to those habits that they grew up with?
It's the habits that also keep them alive, though. I mean, I'm thinking
right.
if you're saying that
survival.
I do drugs and dealing drugs then brings money into the household where I can pay rent, mm-hmm. where my little sister can eat, mm-hmm. where my little brother can have tennis shoes. I understand it's a habit and it's a dangerous habit. But right now, that habit is actually floating and supporting an entire family. And sometimes, you know, it can be in a whole block.
Right. And not to mention my passion, which is lead poison.
Yes.
So
and
many of
Jill
our
P. Carter as well.
So many of our children, so many of our young people
are suffering,
are poisoned by toxic lead. And we have not done a doggone thing to no. make sure they got the treatment, the behavioral treatment, the medical treatment, the nutritional treatment, to make sure that they can actually live at their highest function and undo potentially some of the cognitive
try
damage
to.
Done
yes.
to their brains. So when we're talking about decision making, this anything that is impacting the cognitive function of our children's brain, lead poison, trauma, poverty, these things
yes.
are inhibiting people's ability to make the right decisions.
And we call those the traumatic stresses of childhood experiences, folks. So there's a certain number of them that you have mm-hmm. that you won't be able to work yourself out of. If you're dealing with, as you said, lead poisoning, and you add on that your neighborhood trauma, mm-hmm. you add on that gun violence, you mm-hmm. add on that living in a food desert. Mm-hmm. Like if you keep adding and adding and adding, you can't work yourself out
and
of this.
And not only that, a program can't fix a food
no,
desert.
No, it can't.
A
no.
You got to have structural changes
to change
fix structural problems.
All right, let's get back to the callers. Glord, I'm coming to you. Glord, how are you? Thank you for holding.
Yes. Hi, Dr. K.
Hi.
Since you don't have a green thumb, you need to sing or play music to your flowers, and it might grow. and Dr. Lawrence Brown, he has some good points. Made a lot of sense. There's a couple of issues that I want to comment on, but I'm going to use myself for an example. You know, the root of our problem, and now we're dealing with the fallout in 2018 that we're dealing with. And the youth, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead. We're listening.
Okay. And the youth myself, if you go back with your grandfather, you know, back at South Point, Turner Station, And I was successful because I had four businesses. And believe it or not, in our schools, we had shop, we had, you know, the girls had food cooking, all the above to learn, for me to learn skills. And as I got older, I used, because I was general contract as well, I learned skills from the school, and I learned how to do a lot of things, know how to think and everything. But just recently, but me being in the trenches, I'm a community person.
Right.
And I don't have any kids, but I went to the Board of Education a couple of years ago, and I told the president of the city, let them know they cannot keep tearing the schools down because the school students, you know, people die off, they move out, the kids move out, get married, you know, and then eventually they come back. But in the meantime, I kept telling them, I said, instead of tearing these schools down, you need to put trays in these schools.
Oh, to resource the schools,
boys, right. So these young boys and girls can learn skills. Because now, what we're dealing with now, we're dealing with the fallout. So by them not having no skills and no education and no jobs, you know, and everything, they don't know to spend money among themselves. You know, some learn, but it's a slow process.
Right.
But all these little programs that is in effect, which makes sense. And a lot of people that call in, they got some good ideas. But the root of the problem started, I'm telling you, if you don't get that education, because we use Turner Station as a remote, a role model.
Well, I'm going to stop you there, Gloria. Thank you so much. Education is what GLOAT is focusing on. I want to try to get through all the calls in the last bit of time we have left. We have Jeff. He's a new caller from Maryland. Jeff, welcome to the family.
Hi, Dr. K. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for joining myself and Dr. Brown.
I have a couple of things I want to say, but one thing I've not heard anyone talk about is how impressionable young men of all races can be when they look up to role models, especially media role models.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a program on a few weeks ago to where you were praising that rap music is the number one selling form of music, and that's great. But Dr. K, some of the topics in a lot of these videos and songs that I hear about are not good.
No, I absolutely agree with you.
The
absolutely
videos
agree.
The players in the videos have guns. I mean,
yes.
Even from the Me Too movement, I mean, the things I see in there, it's all anti everything you and I are trying, mm-hmm. to promote for, better living, in the black community. But the media is, these young people are hearing things and seeing things that, you're either cool or, you're either cool with this or you're cast out.
Right.
So I just think that music is a big problem. I mean,
no, I agree
on the
with
other
you.
Side of the fence,
yeah.
White music came under, heavy metal music came under a lot of scrutiny in the 80s with, suicide rates and all that. You remember those.
Yeah,
those,
I remember that. Mm-hmm.
I just think that's a big problem.
I completely agree. And Jeff, I know the show you're talking about, and our show, just to be clear, wasn't in praise of rap music. I was talking about looking at the trends from where black folks spent their money, and it's from both the black community and the white community and the Hispanic community that drove
Absolutely.
Up and made rap the number one biggest industry. In fact, rap sells out more quickly going into the white suburban communities than into our urban communities. So we were talking about
in terms
of trends, yes.
No doubt. It's just that the theme of a lot of this.
Oh, it is very, it's very misogynistic. It's very
disturbing.
It's
going the wrong way.
All right. Thank you so much, Jeff. We have Buddy on the phone from West Baltimore. Buddy, how are you?
Hey, Dr. K. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
That's good. I was thinking about so much, man. There's still many scenarios, man. But not only is we losing our black men, but the things we put our young women through.
Right.
I talked to a guy. He said, Mr. Buddy, you're my counselor. You know, and I said, man, what do you think about the burden when you get locked up, man? The burden you put on your children, mama, that you want her to bring you commissary and take care of your kids while you're gone.
Right. Because there's a big responsibility there.
It's affecting the whole community, but the black men are losing. I always say that because it's in the book. kill all the firstborn male.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
You kill the population growth of a people.
You're absolutely right. Thank you so much, buddy. Now, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Brown, and Paul W. James, Diane Robert, hold on, I'm coming to you. One of the things that we talked about, we were following on the show the nationwide prison strike. And talking about the fact that one of the things that incarcerated residents were fighting for was to have an increase into how much money they were making per month. I mean, per day. And I think at this point, I believe the highest in the federal prison, it might be $2 an hour. It might be $2.50 an hour. But they were arguing that if you pay incarcerated residents more money, because, you know, our call just touched on this, then it's less of an impact on the family. If you pay them more money, then they actually are not missing financially. They can contribute towards home. Given the fact that we do see so many black men here in Maryland, Baltimore specifically, who are incarcerated, do you think that maybe that's one of the ways that we can help restore a little balance? One, I know the main way is to get them out of prison. We know that. Mm-hmm. And to stop the prison, you know, the pipeline. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying while they're there, is that a way we can at least financially begin to bring some balance into these communities? Because when you lose the black man out of the household, either it's your son or your husband or whoever, your uncle, you're losing a potential income source.
Well, I've come around to the notion only recently that we need universal basic income, especially in our marginalized redlined communities. If people had a universal basic income, then we would basically supplement people's income so that they're not living in deep poverty.
Right.
They're not living in poverty at all.
And just to let people know, deep poverty is living off less than $2 a week. That's what, $2 a day.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, my thing is prevention. I come from public health. So, you know, all of the things that a lot of people talk about, you know, solutions, a lot of what they're thinking about is how to fix stuff that's already messed up. My thing is, how can we change the dynamic so that people don't end up in those situations, end up in jail in the first place?
Right.
If we know that poverty is a big prediction for how people end up in prison, then let's do something like universal basic income. Let's do rent control. Mm-hmm. I think rent is sky high in this city for a lot of people that have very low incomes.
Right.
And so I think we got to do some things to make sure people aren't falling through the cracks because they're living in deep poverty and they're trying to make ends meet.
And it's too difficult to do. Dr. Brown and I entered from two different sides. He's dealing with trying to get to the root cause, and I'm dealing with people who are already in the system because I do want to fix it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm involved and would like it to be repaired, but I know that while we're figuring it out and while we're doing these big case studies, people are suffering, and that's what drives me crazy. Long-term solutions for the school, yes, I'm into that. Mm-hmm. While you're working your long-term solutions, what about the kids that are there? So we're saying we just can't deal with them, like talented 10th mentality, and hold them there.
And that's why I wouldn't even say no to your idea. I would just say let's do both.
Yeah, let's do both.
Let's both and. Let's boost the income for folks who are in prison, but then let's also instill universal basic income so that people don't end up in prison in the first place.
I like that. And what are you talking about in terms of the amount for the universal basic income? Like, do you have a hardcore amount or it's just really in the beginning stages?
I would say at least $40,000 a year. We need to do to supplement families so that they're able to at least have $40,000 a year. So if you're making $15,000, we need to kick in $25,000.
Think about that, folks. Given the fact that in this country, the poverty level for a family of four is making under $26,000. So we're talking about getting people above what the poverty level lines are. Let's go back to the phones. We have Robert on the phone. He's been holding for a while. Robert, thank you for holding.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Look, the guy, the doctor, he hit on a lot of points.
Yes.
Especially to have housing and just a lot of things that they researched and made sure that it would work against us. And one thing I want to point out, I've been listening to all the talks over the last 2 years. It's a name that no one wants to bring up.
Okay. What's that name?
Dismantling of all the skills, the Votech schools and everything. It happened under Miss Alice Penderhughes. And this is something with the white males have been practicing the last 30 years. And they were making their moves on our women,
Okay.
And this is how they became so successful and doing what they were doing in terms of making sure there was no skills in the schools, taking languages out, and all these things that would help us or help the young men be successful and be viable in our communities. Oh. And secondly, there's a new movie out. I don't know how long it's been out, but I watched it 2 weeks ago. It's called The Traffickers with Michael Douglas.
Yes.
Now, in the 70s, they used the Godfather metal in terms of saying if you just give the drugs to the niggas.
Right.
Pardon me, okay?
Okay, right, because it is an afternoon drive time show. Go ahead.
Okay, well, they got a new one out. Michael Douglas and a friend of his daughter who was on drugs, he made an analogy to Michael Douglas while he was in the car. And he said to him, if blacks came to whites for drugs in the white community, and the white boys was making $500 or $600, as that one cost there a couple grand a week, they wouldn't be going to MIT or Columbia neither.
Right, you're absolutely right. Thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate you. I appreciate you, Robert. We have Diana from Southeast Baltimore. Diana, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How you doing, Dr.
I'm doing well, thank you.
And Professor Brian, how you doing?
He's doing well.
Water.
Professor Brown made a lot of good points. But, you know, also I want to put in with that lead with the parents, because a lot of these homes are older that people are renting, you know, and they have lead base in their water structure. And if that landlord has not changed those pipes, that copper is getting still in the water, and it's also affecting the adults. You see that behavior that's played out in our community and stuff like that, you know. And when he was saying about how the African-Americans, politicians, when they get into leadership, they lose out or turn their head away from what – and I was there when they passed that bill for Port Covington. And I just said, all of that money going to one man that doesn't even need that money.
Come on.
He could have did it himself with all the money that he's getting in from his products, Under Armour and everything else, you know. But our leaders must understand, like you said, we are flowers and the dirt and everything. They must treat us like that, how we are. You know, we are human. And I tell people, I said, we are human beings. I said, stop treating them like they're not human beings. I said, because when you treat them less than human, they act the way you have portrayed them, because you keep doing it the same thing. People catch on and they can say, okay, this is the way you want me to act. I'm going to act the same way that you want me to act.
All right. Thank you so much, Diane. We have Paul W. on the phone. Hey, Paul, how are you?
How you doing, Dr. King? And
Dr. Brown, yes.
Mm-hmm. Like I said before, we have, and all the calls have been mirroring it and echoing it. We have trades and schools and stuff like that. We got to start back with the young kids, 1 year old and up. We got to start right there. We got to start mirroring them, like the doctor said, taking them out and mirroring them with jobs, not just keep them in school. We got to get them back to home economics and things like that. We teach them how to cook, how to take care of themselves and stuff like that, and get some pride in them and let them know that it's other means to make money.
All right. Thank you so much, Paul W. And then we have James on the phone. James is from West Baltimore. And then, Dr. Brown, I have a question for you, sir. Go ahead, James. How are you?
Yeah, good evening.
I'm doing well.
Well, the black race is beggars sitting on a pot of gold.
Mm-hmm.
You keep saying how poor we are, but yet they spending all the money in the city.
Right.
Ma and Dom is one of the number one cash malls in the country. But we poor. You know, we don't have. And the reason why, Dr. K, they took the trades out the school is because the Latinos is already skilled.
Okay.
They're not going to invest in nobody when people coming over here already in this country already skilled, carpentry, bricklaying, electrical, masonry. Why would they invest in the kids? The black race, listen, y'all don't want to hear this, but there's no more use for the black race.
Okay. All right, well, I think that's a heavy statement to make. Thank you so much, James. I want to come back to you, Dr. Brown, because it's kind of hard to debate whether or not there's use for the black race. I'm just going to put that there and say I completely categorically just reject that statement. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of use for us. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to something Reverend Republican Governor Larry Hogan said about this FDI data. It talks about Baltimore. He said the governor has said that crime in Baltimore is a problem that's not going away. Because he has implemented all these tougher sentences. He's saying that he's going to do more, arresting more violent offenders, having new tough crime laws. But even with those in play, that this crime problem in Baltimore is not going away. Can you talk a little bit about that in a little bit of time we have left?
Yeah, I'm wondering which crime he's talking about. Because I think about structural crime.
Right.
I think about, you know, we've had over 70 of our public schools closed since 2000. We've had over 90 of our rec centers closed since 1980. You know, when you withdraw resources from, and these are happening in predominantly black communities. So when you withdraw those resources, and then you have the toxic pollution down in Curtis Bay, the incinerator, you got the coal dust being put in the air, you got lead in people's homes, also in the water, like the caller said, also in the air, and also in our pipes. So we have toxic environmental injustice. That's a structural crime as well. I think we have to broaden our sense of what we're talking about
right.
when we say violence. Violence is not just somebody shooting somebody. Poisoning our babies, that's violence.
That's violence.
Closing our schools, that's violence. Closing rec centers, that's violence. So I think, you know, the crime that we have to look at is the structural violence that produces the street level violence. And I think we have to make that connection. People are not born killers. But if you put them in environments without resources, without access, and without opportunity, then yes, you will end up with high levels of street crime. But we end up with that because of the structural crime that we are blind to, that we refuse to address, refuse to call out, and refuse to organize in a very powerful way to dismantle the new Jim Crow and Baltimore apartheid once and for all. And so I think that Baltimore apartheid is the major crime that's happening in this city. And until we address that,
mm-hmm.
until we address that in Chicago, in Flint, in Detroit, in St. Louis, our other Category 5 hyper-segregated cities, which means we don't have resources going into black communities.
Mm-hmm.
Black children do not have access, don't have opportunity.
But we have normalized
overabundance
that,
of
right.
hyper-policing and lead poisoning.
I just want to say, we've normalized
that. That's the structural crime.
Right, but we've normalized it.
Well,
I mean, here in Baltimore City, the things you're talking mm-hmm. about, people outside of Baltimore, mm-hmm. politicians supposed to be working on behalf of Baltimore,
right.
see this as the normal behavior of Baltimore.
Right.
That what you're talking right. about is kind of disruption work. I mean, the disruption work is to help them to understand that this is not normal. It is not normal for people to be hyper-segregated in an apartheid-like situation.
Right.
It's not normal for kids to go to school and not have clean water to drink.
Right.
It's not normal that you live in a food desert and you have no access to fresh fruits and vegetables at all. Like,
right.
that's not normal, but we've normalized it in all the places you listed.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago, Flint, Detroit, St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
Baltimore, it's all normal behavior here.
And all the places that have high homicide rates.
And all the places that have a high concentration of black folks who are economically challenged.
Absolutely.
I mean, you got to see the correlation, people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not talking about what's happening in Mount Washington.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about Fells Point. We're talking about very particular, concentrated black economically challenged communities, what they call the black butterfly,
mm-hmm.
which I think is just the best definition if you take a look at it on the map of what is happening in this city. Now, if elected, Ben Jealous said he's going to bring down crime by funding more violence intervention programs, right? The safe streets that we've talked about, and providing funds for city police to bolster their homicide investigations. Because we talked about Hogan, we got to talk about who's running against
mm-hmm.
them. So is that going to bring down crime? If you just put more in safe streets, because you said about 40 of those safe
mm-hmm,
streets program,
mm-hmm.
and you put more money towards the police to solve crimes.
And that's the thing, we're not hearing from either candidate. We're not hearing you know, let's get rid of lead in Baltimore. Let's declare a state of emergency, spend approximately $2 billion.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Minister Carlos Muhammad.
Get rid of lead in black neighborhoods. You know, I think that's what we're going to have to look at. And what I see from both candidates, Republican and Democrat, are either Jim Crow policies from the Republican
mm-hmm.
or very tepid policies that don't go far enough from the Democrat. And I think that's something that we have to really look at. Now, I do look at voting as a form of harm reduction. So I vote Democrat to reduce the harm that I'm going to get from the Republican. But what I'm saying is Democrats have to do better. And we have to push these Democrats to do better. Because in the city, Democrats run this city, but they've maintained Baltimore apartheid. And we got to dismantle that. I don't care who's in charge. We have to dismantle the hyper-segregation. And I'm not talking about black and white people necessarily living next to each other. The main damage of segregation is the lack of resources. And that's what's damaging black communities. Black communities can do just fine if they had equitable resources, equitable access, equitable opportunity.
That was interesting. In this same article, that I just encourage people to go out and take a look at this FBI data. It is fascinating because they can't seem to highlight what is the root of the problem for Baltimore's violent crime problem. Now, there are all kinds of possible solutions. Mm-hmm. They said maybe it could be because of the opioid epidemic, the fallout mm-hmm. from that. Maybe it's because of Baltimore's longstanding status as a heroin market. Maybe it's systemic failures like segregated neighborhoods, which you talked about, mm-hmm. the unequal justice system, mm-hmm. a scarcity of decent opportunities for many of its residents. Maybe it's the police mm-hmm. and predatory policing. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the fact that our politicians sometimes are involved in mm-hmm. maintaining a Jim Crow city. Maybe it's all of that, mm-hmm. and maybe it's none of that.
It is. It's all of that. Mm-hmm. There's rarely a silver bullet to social problems. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times people want to trot out that one little program or solution like it's going to solve everything. It's not. No one program can solve everything. But if you have a systemic structural approach to actually water that soil and create nutritious soil so that the flowers that are humans in our city can grow, then that we got to water the garden.
We got to water the garden
in the red line communities. That's what we have to do.
I like that. I'm going to leave it there. I use that same analogy with my sons. I always talk about watering my flowers. I have a green thumb for everything that's actually a plant, but I'm working on my sons because I'm expecting a great return, right? You want the flowers to grow and to be prosperous. Dr. Lawrence Brown here at Morgan State University, an amazing piece of data and source and resources. He's also on the root list of the 100 most influential African-Americans in the country. Dr. Lawrence Brown, I'm excited to be here with them. Folks, we're going to leave it here for right now. We know that a lot of you couldn't get through. We appreciate you calling anyway. Today with Dr. K's production of WEAA, the show is produced by Justina Pollard with assistance from our intern, Deja Edwards. Our board operators are Andre Melton and Charlie Hines. Stay tuned because up next is For the Culture with Faraji. Remember, folks, here on Today with Dr. K, your voice matters. Your opinion matters. We are telling the stories that matter. We're here for you. We are listening because if it has your ear, you better believe it has our attention. Right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, absolutely the voice of the community. Make an appointment. Meet me back here tomorrow at 3. Let's talk about the stories again together tomorrow. Keep it here for a final update from MTA.
And a good evening. Local link bus diversions include on the Purple Line diverted at Pratt and Pulaski Street going eastbound. The Purple Line westbound diverted at Lombard and Monroe. The Lime Line westbound diversions at Eastern and Eden. And the Lime Line southbound diverted at Caroline and Gulf. Light rail link services discontinue between the Timonium Fairgrounds and Hunt Valley stops through October the 4th. Local link bus number 93 is operating between the affected stations to help accommodate riders. Currently, we are seeing about a 10-minute delay going northbound. No reported delays anywhere on the Metro subway link between Owings Mills and Johns Hopkins, and MTA commuter buses are running on time. For the MTA Transit Team, I'm Ken Berger on 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Minister Carlos Muhammad inviting you to join us each and every Sunday night at 8 p.m. for the Final Call radio broadcast, which features the life-giving teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as presented by his star minister, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. So don't forget, tune in each and every Sunday night at 8 p.m. because we also tackle the important issues of the day that are affecting our community. So don't forget, it's the Final Call right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Explore a broadly defined cosmopolitan jazz scene with me. I'm Marcus Johnson, and I invite you to come catch the flow with me on Sundays from 9 to 11. It's an all-new contemporary jazz program featuring straight-ahead, smooth, and Latin grooves with urban instrumentals, southern jam bands, and soulful vocalists, much, much more. That's Catch the Flow with me, Marcus Johnson, Sundays 9 to 11 on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM.
Celebrating 40 years of broadcasting, Morgan State University Public Radio, 88.9, WEAA FM and HD1, Baltimore. I do this for my
culture. Peace and welcome to For the Culture right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely. The voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in. Tonight, folks, we're going to talk a little bit about something that is very cultural, which is code switching. Should code switching be taught in schools? and does it threaten diversity? We'll have an open conversation about how language and linguistics can potentially impact your future. In what way? There are so many. We're going to share those thoughts with you. Also, we're going to talk about how one prison in Virginia is deciding to ban feminine products. Yeah. Wow. We got that and a whole lot more. Stay riding with me. It's For the Culture right here on your source for cool jazz and more on WEAA. Now let's check in with NPR.